Right. So this is a major issue that I deal with in my book. Most people reading the Bible, of course, assume that Jesus did call himself God. But these claims to divinity are found only in our last gospel, the Gospel of John, where Jesus says things like, I and the Father are one, or where he says, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. The thing is that these statements in which he declares himself God are not found in our earlier Gospels, Matthew, Mark, or Luke. And so most historians have concluded that these claims to be God that are found in John represent a theological understanding of Jesus found in John, but that they're not historically accurate, and that Jesus himself was not going around calling himself God during his public ministry.
Did others in the time frame of Jesus' life, did others, as far as you would assert, regard Jesus as divine in some sense?
I think the answer is absolutely no. He didn't call himself God. If he had called himself God, of course, he would have been stoned to death by the Jewish authorities. And there's nothing to indicate that during his lifetime his disciples understood he was God. In the earliest Gospels, the striking thing is the disciples never do figure out who he is. They may have understood that he was going to be the future Messiah, but Christians need to realize that the term Messiah does not mean God. The Messiah was supposed to be the future king of Israel, who was to be a descendant of King David, and so he'd be a human being like David was, who would be the future king, and it appears that some of his disciples thought that that's who he would be, but that they didn't think that he was divine.
How do you deal with two passages, one in the gospel that you say comes earliest, the appellation, so to speak, in Mark's gospel that comes at the death of Jesus from the centurion, surely he was the Son of God?
Yes, I think the gospel writers, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, do understand that Jesus is God. That's a different question from whether Jesus considered himself to be God. Writing some 30 or 40 years later, Mark does understand that Jesus is God, but he understands that Jesus is God in a different sense from the way he's understood to be God in the Gospel of John. And so when the centurion says, this man is the Son of God, it's actually echoing the words that are heard at the baptism in the same Gospel in Mark chapter 1, where Jesus is baptized and the voice from heaven, in other words, a voice from God, cries out, you are my beloved Son in whom I'm well pleased. And so for Mark's Gospel, Jesus is definitely the Son of God.
I'm trying to sort this out. Are you making an assertion about the evolution of a doctrine, namely the deity of Christ, historically, or are you taking it a step further and saying this Jesus himself was not God, the later claims to deity that are put into his mouth in John's gospel, or into the mouths of those who were alleged to be part of his life, the centurion, Peter's great confession at Caesarea Philippi, things like that, that those are essentially made up to bolster a teaching that had come into being over time?
Okay, so I think it's important to clarify a couple of things. One is, I am not making any theological claims at all. I'm not saying that I think Jesus was God. I'm not saying that Jesus was not God. My book isn't about theology. My book is about history. My question is, how did this belief about Jesus as God develop? Everybody would agree, except for the most rabid fundamentalists, that Jesus was not going around calling himself the second member of the Trinity during his ministry. And yet, in 300 years later, people were saying that he was the second member of the Trinity. And my question is, how did that happen? How did that historical progression take place? So that's one thing to be clear on. The second thing to be clear on is that there's a difference between what the historical Jesus actually said and what the Gospels say he said. This isn't a particularly radical claim. This is what scholars have been saying for over 200 years. This is just part of scholarship, is realizing that the Gospels are portraying Jesus in light of their own views about him. And to understand what the historical Jesus was really like, we have to get behind the Gospels to establish what Jesus himself said. And so my view is the view that's widely held among scholars, that Jesus didn't call himself God, but that the later Gospel writers did see him as God and portrayed him that way.
How would you respond to one of the criticisms, and you're speaking here about the long history, 200-year history of what's generally called higher criticism or the historical critical method. How would you respond to a criticism of that method that says, look, what you're really doing here, Dr. Ehrman, is you're deciding in advance which material is going to be closer to authenticity and which is going to be farther from authenticity. And then you're simply reading those classifications of which material is authentic, which isn't, into the text. How do you respond to that criticism?
I think it's precisely wrong. It's not what scholars do. And what scholars do is they establish criteria for determining what happened in the past. This isn't just about the historical Jesus. It's about any historian. If you want to know what happened in the life of Julius Caesar, you have to look at your sources and decide on the basis of rigorous historical criteria where the sources are giving you reliable information. You don't make that decision in advance because the entire enterprise involves trying to find out about the past. It's not assuming that you know what happened in the past and then trying to prove it. It's trying to find out what happened in the past, whether you're talking about Julius Caesar or Napoleon or Jesus.
So what is the criteria for deciding the claims to divinity, wherever they may be? Say, we've talked about Matthew and Mark, which are earlier than John. What's the criterion for deciding that those are later rather than very early?
It's the same criteria that you would use for any historical investigation. I mean, sometimes it's useful to think about it like when you're trying to figure out what happened in a crime scene today. You have a court case, and the prosecution brings forth a number of people who can give their testimony, and if their testimony is basically in line with one another and they haven't collaborated ahead of time, well, that's good evidence. And especially if you have witnesses who testify things that actually are against what they would like to be true, well, that's good testimony. And it's the same thing with historical evidence about Julius Caesar and Napoleon or Jesus. If you've got a lot of witnesses that basically agree on certain claims, and if they are saying things that are disinterested, that are different from what they themselves personally subscribe to, those things are historical. And so we're not doing anything particularly different from what people do every day of their lives. We're just applying what we do in our everyday lives to figure out what happened in the past to the historical Jesus.
So you say in your latest book, How Jesus Became God, the reason we need books like these, your book, is that the Gospels cannot simply be taken at face value as giving us historically reliable accounts of the things Jesus said and did. Why can't they be taken at face value? Give us a kind of a nutshell answer.
The nutshell answer is, again, it's like a courtroom scene. If you've got witnesses that disagree with each other all over the place, then they are not all telling it the way it was. They can't be. So if you have, say you have two eyewitnesses to an automobile accident and they contradict each other on key points, then, well, they both can't be right. One of them might be right or they both might be wrong, but they both can't be right. The problem with the Gospels of the New Testament is that they have numerous discrepancies on both major and minor issues. And if that's true, then they're like eyewitnesses to an automobile accident. They both can't be right, or all four can't be right. And so you have to devise criteria for deciding which ones are right and at what places.
Now, I guess what I'm wondering at that point is, back to your analogy of the car accident, one might say the car was gray. One might say the car was light blue, those kind of discrepancies. Some might say, well, he pulled into the intersection first, or they don't know which sequence of events. They disagree on the sequence of events. But they do all agree that there was a car accident.
Yeah, well, and everybody agrees there was a Jesus. So the thing is that if you say that car A ran the red light and ran into the other car, and someone else says car B is the one that ran the red light and ran into the other car, well, I mean, either they both, I mean, you know, one or the other is right, or they're both wrong. And so that's what it is with the Gospels. You have contradictory statements, and so the contradictory statements can't both be right.
Okay, so what's the actual, to extend the analogy, what's the actual car accident? Who is Jesus? Who was Jesus, really? as opposed to who the gospel writers made him out to be?
Well, of course, you know, the evidence comes from the Gospels themselves, and I think it's quite clear that if you study the Gospels from a historical point of view, without assuming that you know the answer to your investigation, but you approach it like you would approach the study of Julius Caesar or Napoleon, that if you use the Gospels as sources, it becomes clear that the historical Jesus was a Jewish preacher from Galilee who was proclaiming that God was soon going to intervene in history to overthrow the forces of evil and set up a good kingdom on earth. This would be a kingdom in which there'd be no more oppression or injustice or suffering, and God would rule his people. And Jesus appears to have thought that he himself would be the king of this coming kingdom.
Then, of course, there's more assertions in the Gospels than simply that there was a Jesus, as you said. There's complete agreement that this Jesus was crucified, and there's complete agreement that this Jesus was raised from the dead, isn't there?
Yes, absolutely.
So how do you deal with those events in terms of, you know, the historical Jesus? How do you sort out the complete agreement among the people who at least claim to be eyewitnesses that Jesus actually rose from the dead? And then we have Paul, as you say in your book, very early, somewhere in the mid-50s, I think is what you say, assuming the resurrection as physical fact.
Who are you saying claim to be eyewitnesses?
Well, at least they claimed, the gospel writers, but some of them claim to be eyewitnesses or based upon eyewitness accounts.
No, they don't.
How is that?
Well, they don't. I mean, when you read Matthew's gospel, Matthew does not claim to be an eyewitness.
But Luke does claim to base his prologue, doesn't he?
Luke says that the traditions have been handed down by eyewitnesses, but he doesn't say he's interviewed any of them, and none of them claim to be eyewitnesses. So these do not claim to be eyewitness reports.
So you would discount what people have understood John's gospel, that this
John
this
doesn't
writer...
claim to be an eyewitness either. These are not disputed points. I mean, all you have to do is read the Gospels. The Gospels do not claim to be eyewitnesses. So, I mean, to get to your point, though, about crucifixion, yeah, absolutely, Jesus was crucified for calling himself the King of the Jews. That's what all the Gospels report, and it's historically virtually certain that that's why Jesus was killed. That's interesting because he wasn't killed for committing blasphemy. None of the accounts say that he was killed for calling himself God. When he's put on trial before the Roman procurator, the Roman prefect, Pontius Pilate, the accusation against him is not, did you call yourself God? The accusation is, do you call yourself the King of the Jews? Jesus is convicted on those charges, and the placard over his head then reads that this is the King of the Jews. So that is, I think, historically certain that Jesus was executed because he was calling himself King of the Jews, not because he was calling himself God.
And the resurrection, how do you deal with that event?
Resurrection is a really complicated point, and so I devote two chapters of this to my book on how Jesus became God, because I think the resurrection is absolutely the key to knowing why it is Christians started calling Jesus God if they didn't call him God during his lifetime. It's because the early followers of Jesus believed he was raised from the dead that they came to think that he was a divine being and not merely a human being. And so it is absolutely fundamental to know why it is they thought he had become this divine being at the resurrection. And so I devote two rather lengthy chapters to what we can say about the resurrection from a historical perspective rather than from a theological perspective. The theological perspective, of course, for Christians is that Jesus was raised from the dead. The problem is that historians in any field, whether they are studying the Second World War or whether they're studying Elizabethan England or whether they're studying medieval Europe or if they're studying early Christianity, historians cannot invoke miracle as an explanation for what happens historically. People get upset about that when you talk about the historical Jesus, but it's simply a reality. If you read a book about World War II, written by a bona fide historian, you will never have a historian say that the reason the Allies won is because God intervened and did a miracle. historians don't talk about miracles because they can't talk about miracles. So this is true of every historian in the world. And so historians can't say for sure that Jesus was raised from the dead, and historians can't say for sure that Jesus was not raised from the dead. The resurrection is a miracle, and since it's a miracle, it's not something that historians can talk about. What historians can say is that some of the followers of Jesus had visions of him after his death, and on the basis of these visions, they came to believe that he had been raised from the dead. I think that's absolutely certain historically. Christians would say the reason they had visions was because Jesus rose from the dead and he appeared to them. Non-Christians would say, well, they were hallucinating. But either way, you can say Jesus certainly was the disciples of Jesus certainly said that they saw him alive afterwards.
What about the predictions that are found in, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, all of the Gospels in some form or another?
About Jesus being raised from the dead?
Yeah, Jesus' own prediction not only of the manner of his death, but also of his resurrection.
Yeah, well, we don't know. Historians, as I said, have to evaluate witnesses based on the witnesses' biases. So that if a mother of a person who's being accused of murder is on the witness stand, you have to take into account the fact that she's his mother. And so she's likely to say something that coincides with what she wants, which is to get her son off the hook. So that's true not only in court cases, it's true with historical sources. Historical sources themselves, of course, have to be interrogated. That's what doing history involves. History doesn't simply involve accepting what a source says because a source says it. So, in Mark's gospel, Jesus three times predicts he's going to be raised from the dead. But Mark, the gospel of Mark, the author, believed Jesus was raised from the dead. And so do you know, based on that fact, do you know that Jesus predicted his resurrection? The answer is no, you don't know. Could he have? Yes, he could have. Is it probable he did? You can't say. Because you don't have the kind of sources that would indicate it.
So, to put it plainly, a mother who's trying to get her son off the hook and she's on the stand will perjure herself, right?
Not necessarily. If she says, yes, he did it, then she's saying something against her self-interest, and that's something you can trust, because it's against her self-interest. So if you have a witness who witnesses against his or her self-interest, that's a good piece of information.
Are the gospel writers perjuring themselves?
No, because they're saying what they believe. They're not lying.
But they're simply saying, this is what I believe happened.
Yes.
Let's talk about the evolution to the deity of Jesus Christ. How did it go? Give us the sequence of events in broad strokes, how Jesus goes from being a Galilean Jewish preacher to an elevated figure, and as you say, and then finally to a divine figure.
Yeah, so the way it works is, to understand how it works, you have to know something about what ancient people thought about gods and humans. And so my first couple chapters deal with the understanding of the divine realm in Greek and Roman circles, so pagan circles, and the second chapter is what Jews thought. And it turns out people in the ancient world didn't understand things the way we do. Even ancient Jews agreed with Greeks and Romans that the divine realm had a number of layers to it. That there, of course, there's the one true God who created all things, but there are other divine beings under God. And there were some Jews who thought that that God had a second God alongside of him, who was worshipped along with the true God. So these people, Greeks, Romans, and Jews, understood that sometimes humans could be gods. You find this throughout Greek and Roman mythology, but you also find it in the Hebrew Bible, in the Old Testament. One of the ways that a person can become a divine being is by being exalted up to heaven. The earliest Christians believed that at the resurrection, Jesus had been exalted up to heaven, and it's at that point that they started saying that Jesus is God, because God made him a God at the resurrection. As some time passed, Christians started saying, well, Jesus must not have been God only at the resurrection. He must have been divine starting with his entire ministry. And so the baptism that happened at the beginning of his ministry is when he became a divine being, became a God. Then they thought about it more, and they said, well, actually, not just during his ministry. He must have been a divine being from the point that he came into the world. And so they started telling stories about Jesus being born of a virgin, so that in the virgin birth stories in Matthew and Luke, which are not found in Mark, in Matthew and Luke, Jesus becomes God at his conception, because God is literally his father. As people thought about it more, they thought, well, Jesus has been God not just from the time of his conception. He was God before he came into the world. And so they started saying that Jesus was a divine being who started out as a divine being, who became human temporarily. And that's the view you get in the Gospel of John. So you can actually trace this view historically through our Gospels to see what the earliest views were and then what the later views were. And this later view of John then became the standard view, that Jesus was a pre-existent divine being. He existed with God before the creation of the world, and then he became a human being. That's very different from what the earliest Christians believed, but it became the standard belief within Christianity.
How would you characterize what the earliest Christians believed about him?
The very first Christians believed that when Jesus was raised from the dead, God had made him a divine being. This is a view that you find in some of the speeches of Acts, for example, such as Acts 13, verse 32 and 33. It's a view that you find in some materials quoted by Paul, such as in Romans chapter 1, verses 3 and 4, that it's at the resurrection that Jesus is made the Son of God.
Let's talk a bit about the details of the crucifixion and resurrection. You said definitely crucified, but crucified for claiming to be essentially a rival to Caesar in some sense. The creeds put some emphasis on the fact that he is crucified, dead, and buried. What about his burial? Do you contend with that, the claims of the Gospels there?
Yeah, I do. This is something I changed my mind on doing my work on this book. So in the Gospels, of course, Jesus is crucified, and Joseph of Arimathea, a member of the Jewish Sanhedrin, asks for his body, and Pilate gives it to him to give him a proper burial. And I thought that that was probably historical for years and years. I mean, all my entire life, I thought that was historical until I started looking into the matter more carefully about 8 months ago. What I decided to do was to look at Roman practices of crucifixion. And as it turns out, it is a commonplace in ancient references to crucifixion that the person of the crucified figure was left on the cross after his death as part of the punishment, so that the punishment was not merely the slow, torturous death of crucifixion. It was also, the punishment was involved the ravages on the body afterwards, as the body was left to decompose on the cross and be eaten by scavengers. We have numerous references in ancient Roman and Greek sources that this is what happened to crucified criminals. And so the idea was that people wanted a decent burial, but they weren't allowed a decent burial because that was part of the punishment, part of the humiliation. And so the only question is whether Jesus was an exception to the rule. And what I argue in the book is that there's very little reason to think that Jesus was the exception to the rule, that Pilate was not the kind of person who was sensitive to what his ruled subjects wanted to do religiously, and that Jesus probably then was left on the cross for a couple of days and probably then tossed into a common grave of some kind.
So what does that do to the resurrection accounts that center around a tomb?
The interesting thing in the Gospels is that the empty tomb never leads anybody to believe. And there's a reason for that. You know, if you put a body in a tomb and 3 days later you go back to the tomb and the body's not there anymore, your first thought is not, oh, he's been raised from the dead. Your first thought is, somebody stole the body. Or you think, hey, I'm at the wrong tomb. You don't think resurrection. In the Gospels, the empty tomb does not make anybody believe. What makes people believe is that they have visions of Jesus afterwards. And this, of course, is what Paul says. Paul, our earliest witness, doesn't say anything about an empty tomb. He says that the reason that people came to believe is because they had visions of Jesus. And that's what happens in the Gospels as well. It's Jesus appearing to people that makes them believe that he's been raised from the dead. So that even if there wasn't an empty tomb, In other words, even if there wasn't a known tomb by Joseph of Arimathea, but Jesus was, say, thrown into a common grave, you could still have the appearances of Jesus. He could still be believed to have been raised from the dead by his followers afterwards.
So the tomb is a contrivance, a well-intended contrivance to kind of establish what, that Jesus isn't dead?
The early Christians thought Jesus was bodily raised from the dead, and so when they told their stories, I'm not saying that they lied about it. I'm not saying somebody like intentionally said, you know, I'm going to fabricate this. But as stories get told, things get changed in the process of the telling and the retelling, especially when they're told over decades. These are stories that are being circulated for 30 or 40 years before anybody writes them down. And so in the process of retelling, there comes to be the story about Joseph of Arimathea and the empty tomb, because that supports the idea that Jesus was bodily raised from the dead. How do you know he was bodily raised from the dead? Because, well, we know his tomb, and his body was no longer in it.
Okay, Jody Magnus, I believe, is a colleague of yours at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and she's a Jewish archaeologist. She has, I guess, studied the Jewish council practices and even Roman practices with the Jews, not generally with all, you know, of their subjects, but with the Jews, that they were permissive of Jewish practices in terms of taking bodies off the cross and things like that and giving them proper burials. And what she has said, and I read this recently, I'll quote her here, she says, "The gospel accounts of Jesus' removal from the cross and burial are largely consistent with the archaeological evidence and with Jewish law." Are you saying that Dr. Magnus is incorrect there?
Yes, I am. She hasn't read my book, and I haven't talked with her about it, but she is incorrect. We don't have a single case of a Jewish person being taken off a cross in order to be buried before the Sabbath, the way the Gospels say happened with Jesus. We don't have a single instance of that in any historical record, period.
Why didn't this is my term, Dr. Ehrman, the evolution, so to speak, why didn't it continue? Why did it stop at kind of the Nicene creedal formulation of Jesus, second person of the Trinity, begotten of the Father from all eternity, born of a virgin, crucified, died, buried, and ascended? Why did it stop there? Why didn't it continue to evolve into something more?
Well, I don't think it could have evolved into anything more if you're going to maintain that God the Father is absolutely God, because what this ended up saying was that Christ was fully equal with God the Father. So there's no place to go from there. I mean, in the Nicene Creed, Jesus isn't subordinate to God. It's not that he's, you know, merely the second member of the Trinity. It's that as the second member of the Trinity, he is of the same substance with the Father. He is co-eternal with the Father. He's always existed with the Father. He's fully equal with the Father. So there's no place to go above that. That's as high as you can get.
Finally, Dr. Ehrman, we've talked before, and I've made it clear to you that my view of Jesus is that creedal view of Jesus, that when I look at the Gospels, I do believe that they are historically reliable accounts. And to kind of put it in personal terms, I trust that Jesus. I pretty much, that's all I've got to hang on to, especially when the rubber meets the road on my deathbed. It's that Jesus that I find there in the Gospels and as formulated in the historic creeds of the church. He's all I'm left with on my deathbed, to tell you the truth. What does your Jesus, the historical Jesus, do for you on your deathbed?
Well, I should say that I don't think you should close your eyes to the realities of the Gospels. If you want to say the Gospels have no discrepancies because that's going to help you on your deathbed, that's one thing. But the reality is the Gospels do have discrepancies, and I can show them to you time after time after time. If you want to refuse to believe that they're there because you're afraid of how you're going to die, then I think that that's just an ostrich putting his head in the sand. The historical Jesus for me tells me not how to die, it tells me how to live. For me, the historical Jesus taught that if you're going to enter into this kingdom of God, you need to live a life of love. And that's how I believe we ought to live our lives, that we ought to love one another, we ought to give of ourselves to one another, we ought to sacrifice for the sake of other people, because there are so many people suffering in the world, we ought to do something about it. So it's really not about, am I going to go to heaven when I die, which is a very self-centered understanding, in my view, of why to believe. In my view, we should be self-giving rather than self-centered, and that Jesus is the one who shows us how to do that.
It is the Easter season. One last question, if you permit it. You can't basically kind of take the agnostic view in your book of Jesus' resurrection. So it kind of naturally leads me to the question. I do not mean this in a capricious way, but is the historical Jesus dead?
Yes, he is. He died, and we're all going to die, and the world's going to die. The universe is going to end. Things do come to an end. And Jesus himself personally died, but his message of love can live on, and we should live according to that message.
So after death, does the historical Jesus deliver you into life? Is there a kingdom beyond that for you?
No, there's no life after death. For the mosquito I just swat, or for my cat who just died, or for me. This is the end of the story. So our lives now are not dress rehearsals for something that's going to happen later. This life is all there is, and so we should live life to the fullest now, because this is a great gift that we have. And we should help other people who are not able to live full lives now, because this is all there is for them as well. And so there's not an afterlife that's going to make right all that's wrong. We have to make what's wrong now, because this is it.
Dr. Bart Ehrman is Distinguished Professor of Religious Studies at the University of North Carolina. He's author of several books, including his latest, How Jesus Became God, The Exaltation of a Jewish Preacher from Galilee. Dr. Ehrman, thank you very much for your time.
Okay, thank you.